I am Reese Tisdale, and this is Future Water, in which we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. This is episode 56 for all of you out there. That means there are 55 other episodes you can go back into your podcast platform and download to listen to hear things about digital water, water infrastructure investment, algae blooms, Suez Veolia, lead in the pipes, and how to solve those problems. All of the above. There's lots of it, lots of Bluefield guests, and lots of, I think, interesting points that many people, including some of my family, find interesting. But today, what's it going to be about? Well, today I'm joined by my colleague, Steph Aldock, to talk about the Queen. Actually, we're not going to talk about the Queen. There probably might be a mention of it. But we're going to talk about Jackson, Mississippi. After lots of discussions internally, lots of questions coming our way, a little bit of frustration, I'm not going to lie, we thought we'd share some thoughts on the latest water crisis in the U.S., but not the only water crisis, and certainly not the last one. So without belaboring the discussion, let's get into it with Steph. All right, Steph, how's it going? Welcome to the Future of Water.
Hey, Reese, it's good to be here. Major heat wave in the Bay Area. People are pretty dramatic about it. I feel like it's just a regular day in August in DC in the 90s, but there's no AC here. So it's definitely impactful.
Actually, raises a good point, you know, as I was sort of leading into the intro to talk about Jackson, but we're really talking about infrastructure and, you know, in the case of California, and it's not really unrelated in many respects. If you look at infrastructure nationally, major heat wave, not only has there been a heat wave in California and the Pacific Northwest, we've seen it in Texas as well. Power infrastructure is just redlining, basically running at its limits. Have you had any brownouts yet?
Not yet, but Newsom sends an alert. Don't plug in your fans between 4 and 8 p.m. to keep the electricity down. So trying to do my part.
All right, well, all this COVID swimming pools will come in handy maybe. So
exactly.
So, well, let's get to it. So the way this all started was we've been kicking around Jackson for the better part of a week and a half since the news really broke that, you know, the city has gone into a boil water advisory. So one of the things was, well, hey, you know, let's talk about this. I think we have a perspective coming out on it, what others might call a blog post on our website. But then you would raise some questions internally. So we thought we'd sort of, once again, flip the script. You could fire away some questions and sort of get some, my perspectives on what's happening. So I just turn it over to you and let you fire away.
Yeah, so let's jump in. I mean, in case anybody's missed it, I don't know how that's possible, but just in case they've been distracted with the Queen or anything else, what's been happening in Jackson, Mississippi?
All right, so simply put, they have gone under an advisory. The city government has said no one should be drinking the water. There have been heavy rains, which have impacted the water supplies, created sediment. That's really one aspect. Maybe that's sort of the last straw on the water infrastructure assets and sort of in their operations. The treatment system as a whole, pumps, pipes, operations, they've been failing for some time. So this is not a new problem, so to speak. But the result is we've got the capital of Mississippi, the state's largest city, 150 or so thousand people have lost access to water for the better part of a month. And it may even extend before that. So, you know, we've talked about Cape Town in the past and day zeros. Well, this is kind of what day zero is like. It just happens to be we're in Mississippi and not South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Cape Town came to my mind as well. And this isn't the first time this has happened, right? In Jackson, they've had other boil water advisories.
No, and I'm you know, alluding to that a little bit in your response to your first question that, you know, the city, the state, the feds have known about this for some time. And to that point, to give you an idea, in 2015, after negotiations, the state, the EPA, the city, the Department of Justice, they all came to terms on a consent decree to address overflows of wastewater and violations. So I think the number we've seen reported is about, you know, there were at least reported 2,300 violations of the Clean Water Act. which is really wastewater related. So a different problem because it's wastewater and not drinking water, but nonetheless, a city, a financial and infrastructure asset problem. But then also more recently, in recent years, we've seen winter storms that have impacted the city. So it's the South. They're obviously not accustomed to extreme cold weather events, should I say. So the most recent one of note, even the Texas winter storm, there were water main breaks that were causing problems in the city. And so when that happens, they go into boil water advisories. People have to drink either bottled water, or they have to truck it in. It's an incredibly expensive endeavor for an incredibly poor population. But it's not unique to Mississippi or Jackson, should I say, but it is has become a poster child. And now here we are. They don't have water once again, because now it seems the drinking water system as a whole has completely failed.
Yeah, so that touches on my next question. I mean, do you think this is specific to Mississippi? Or do you think we've been talking a long time about failure of infrastructure across the board, not enough investment in water infrastructure? Is Mississippi unique, or what do you think there?
All right, so we've sort of debated on how to address this. I mean, so just to put things in context, right? We're just look at the national level, right? We've seen problems in other cities. My take is that this is really the tip of the iceberg, right? And I mean, in a way, not to be hyperbolic, but I mean, is it similar to climate change, right? It's like we're sort of watching these happen a little bit. It's like death by a thousand cuts. So I'll give you some facts on sort of where the state of the U.S. water market is, generally speaking. So the big number that gets kicked around, we've used it, but the EPA has reported that the U.S. experiences about 270,000 water main breaks a year. So pretty significant, right? So 270,000, you know, they're not cheap to repair. When they do happen, it can range anywhere from $5,000 to $50,000, maybe more, to repair these things. So you get all these water main breaks. But, you know, out of sight, out of mind, people forget that there's 4 million miles of water and wastewater pipes underground. So it's an incredible feat that it extends that much, but they're all getting old, right? And we are seeing pipes that are, one was repaired, just there's a water main break in Boston Common, right in the middle of the city just a month or two ago. It was 100-year-old pipe. It was repaired, I think, in the 70s, maybe 1972, 75, if I recall. So even still, you know, it's been 50 years since it was repaired. So infrastructure, whether it be Boston or whether it be in Jackson or whether it be in California, it's getting old. Some more nitty-gritty details is that, sure, our bottom-up analysis, we've gone through thousands of systems and looked at non-revenue water. That includes billing, but also leakage. And the national average for leakage is about 14%. So 14, 15%, that's about right. That's just the average. So we're seeing systems that are having leakage rates that exceed 30, sometimes 40%. So it may be an anomalous situation, but we are seeing major extremes. And the cost of these, is per our numbers, is about $6 billion a year to repair these leaks for the infrastructure service providers overall. So that is a major problem. Most of those leaks are happening in small systems, and I'll get to number in a second on that. The federal government, I know everybody's excited about the IIJA and sort of this post-pandemic, post-recession, these dollars, but federal spending on water and wastewater infrastructure peaked in 1976 when it was about 16% of the total. Now it's down to 4%, and it continues either flatline or trend downward. So what that means is local communities, cities, and to some extent states, Jackson being a good example, they're left to fend for themselves. But within that mix, what's also even more interesting when you look at the total spend, this is, I think, in my mind, maybe the biggest problem or the biggest red flag, is that in 1976, when you looked at the dollars being spent on water and wastewater infrastructure, 1976, it was 50-50 split between capital expenditures and operating expenditures, meaning capital investment into the infrastructure, the assets, operating was just to maintain, keep the systems going, 50-50. That number has shifted since then to now 35 is percent is going to capital investment, and now 65 is going to the O&M, which means we've shifted towards a more reactive approach to our water and wastewater assets, and we're not reinvesting in the system. So things are starting to fall apart. We're not replacing them at the rate that is needed, whether it be the treatment systems and the pipes. Last data point, not to drag on this, but just so everybody knows, there are 49,000 water systems in the U.S., and only 415 of them serve more than 100,000 people. Point being is there are a lot of really small underfunded systems across the U.S., and so rate bases are really the primary source of funding for that, for supporting those systems. So as a result, you know, if it's a poor community, they can't pay for all of the infrastructure needs of the city. So sorry to drag on that, but those are some key facts, but I'm happy to answer more questions on that.
No, those are some really good points. I do want to dive into IIJA, but first let's talk a little bit more about Mississippi. So is it, you know, was it a drinking water issue? Is it a failure of the wastewater treatment plan? Is it, you know, not as simple as we can just go invest in the pipes? Do you think it, again, sort of Mississippi water infrastructure across the board, or is there any specific pain point there that you see?
Well, I mean, this is a drinking water problem that they have now, but when you take into account water and wastewater needs, then you have to pay for both. So a city can't just say, I'm just going to, you know, invest in water or drinking water infrastructure. I'll deal with wastewater later. As we started, you know, they're already under a consent decree for wastewater treatment system problems, right? And sewer overflows. So it's really, and when we've done our forecast looking not only at Mississippi, but also the rest of the U.S., and most of the funding being allocated does go towards wastewater, actually. So the national average is about 57% goes towards wastewater capital expenditures, whereas the remainder goes towards drinking water. That's shifting a little bit because of some federal funding changes that have happened because of recent policies. But so you can't say it's one or the other. You know, most systems, they do operate, many of them is a better way to put it, do run, you know, water and wastewater. And, you know, you can't just say, oh, water's, you know, you can't survive without water. That's all we should focus on. Because really one of the greatest human health achievements in the world is really centralized wastewater treatment. I mean, it saved millions, if not billions of lives over the past 100, 150 years. So, you know, it's kind of both, you know, to say that it's one or the other, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think some people don't realize that, you know, both need to be considered, both the drinking water and the wastewater side. Let's talk a little bit about disadvantaged communities. You mentioned that. I mean, Jackson, Mississippi is a, you know, poor community. We all know Flint, Michigan had some water quality issues a while back. I believe Newark had some lead issues as well. And do you think that so-called disadvantaged communities are getting hit harder with water infrastructure problems that like a Boston or San Francisco isn't? Or again, not to be a broken record, but is it, you know, across the board?
So this is sort of it's not even a $64 million question. It's the one that is right before our eyes, but people get uncomfortable talking about. It's become incredibly charged for a lot of different reasons. So that's sort of the discomfort. But the bottom line is disadvantaged communities, which are defined differently state to state, according to, you know, when we talk about, you know, federal funding and such, they're leaving it to states how to define it. But the bottom line is they're getting screwed. They don't have, I mean, it's kind of obvious, right? When you live in a disadvantaged community, I mean, Mississippi being a great place, you've got the city of Jackson, 25% of the city lives below the poverty line. They're trying to scrape it together one way or another. However they do it, they're trying to pull things together. They don't have time to call up their water utility to, hey, what's my water quality? You know, is it been tested? Do I have lead in my water? Do I have PFAS? They've got so many other problems. I mean, you and I, we both have families. Our lives, you know, relatively, they can be kind of tough. Like our days are full from beginning to end. But put yourself in their shoes, it's even worse. And so the power, the people in power, more often than not, truth be told, they're not impacted. And I'll just give you one quick example, unrelated to water. As everybody listening to this, I live in the city of Boston. The train set, part of, big chunk of the Boston train system has been shut down. The arms line has been shut down for a month. The feds came in and said, this thing is a disaster. You need to deal with this. You haven't been investing in what is infrastructure, much like water and wastewater. Am I impacted by that? No, I live downtown. I walk to the office. I drive to pick up my kids. I do what I have to do. I go to soccer practice. Most people being impacted are those getting up at 5 a.m, getting on the train, trying to get into the city so they can go clean buildings, work in restaurants, service workers, people coming from poor neighborhoods. That's who's really getting screwed, as I said, in this whole deal. So I think we just need to own it. And I think we're moving in that direction. It's never going to be as fast as anybody wants, but I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, no, I think that's, it's important that we acknowledge that. I do think we could do a full podcast on the Boston train system. But let's talk about some good news. You mentioned IIJA. Is there anything specific in IIJA to address this on the infrastructure side or the disadvantaged community side?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a good segue because, you know, we're talking about disadvantaged communities. Disadvantaged communities are getting a huge chunk, relatively speaking, of that funding. So, you know, we've looked at water, wastewater infrastructure from, you know, top to bottom in the IIJA bill and legislation. And there's $55 billion dedicated specifically to water. When we've gone into it, our numbers show, you know, actually the opportunity actually swells to about 100, 110 billion. So it is significantly larger, but a big chunk of that goes to disadvantaged communities. And a big part of that is really going to things like lead remediation, which is really not part of the water network. It's really more on the household side. It sort of operates in the gray area or exists in the gray area between the utility and the property owner. But, you know, poor neighborhoods, disadvantaged communities have been shown to be more impacted, Flint being a good example. There's also PFAS, other emerging contaminants. So to my earlier point, that is a positive first step towards addressing some of these problems that we've known that have been there for a long time. And there are going to be more problems like emerging contaminants coming down the pipe, no pun intended. So I think that's really positive. I think if there's what I would hope is that this is the first step of many, that we can't just address our water, wastewater infrastructure post-crisis, whether it be that using the ARRA funding after the Great Recession to now we're dealing with IIJA because of the pandemic and whatever other drivers there are. But there are other things happening as well. I mean, there's things like, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act as well that will have some impact on just climate and other related things that, you know, that should help things like drought. I mean, you're the one living in sort of brownout, blackout territory without potential power. So reducing droughts would be a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's really promising that they do have specific carve-outs in IIJA for disadvantaged communities. I did read on AWWA's website that, you know, the issue is really, will they be able to carry that out, right? Will the funds go to the right cities and the right states? Because I think that, you know, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out, but it's definitely a good sign.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think Jackson has been sort of inflicted by some of that as well. They've deployed technology solutions and other things that are supposed to help or make the system more efficient. But on the backside of all of this is you have to have experienced people. You have people that understand how to operate the system. You also have funds to pay these people. And it's kind of hard to do that these days. I mean, with inflation and other things happening in the world, that in and of itself has become more difficult, but a critical issue. Like I always say, just because you go to the container store and buy a bunch of plastic buckets and bring them home doesn't mean you're organized. You kind of have to execute on it.
Yeah. So let's switch gears a little bit. When we looked up Mississippi in our Data Navigator platform, I think many of the systems came up as small. What do you think is going to happen in the wake of Jackson? Do you think the bigger utilities will acquire these smaller systems? Do you see this leading to more privatization?
So it's a good question. And it did come up early on. So, you know, an argument that could be made is, oh, why don't we just privatize all these systems? I sort of laid out the number of systems, the small ones. The small ones, that's really where the M&A activity really takes place. I think 65 to 75% of utility acquisitions in the U.S., of which they're anywhere from 150 to 200 a year, they're really for small systems. Big ones are really tough to acquire. They're, once again, politically charged. They take a long time. I mean, Jackson is in a sort of in a bad state. So I think this really is going to fall on the state, the city, and they're going to have to figure this out. And maybe the feds are going to have to step in, whether it be using IIJA funds, also state revolving fund data. You know, I think to your point, I think in Data Navigator, we see that Mississippi has, I think it's about 1,000, almost 1,100 small systems in the state itself. We've seen, I think Central States has been active in Mississippi. They've been buying some systems there, and they've been really, they've been the most active buyer as far as like number of systems being bought over the past year or two. What it does, sort of to wrap it up, and my answer to that question is, it just raises questions about the state of our infrastructure and would a private operator do a better job? And if back to the leakage numbers, one thing that really came out when we were looking at leakage rates, well, the national average is 14, 15%. The real divide was between large privately run systems and small privately run systems. You know, that's really, there was a huge difference where the private investor-owned utilities, I mean, I think they were closer to 10%. You know, if anything, they were keeping that average down. It's a much smaller share of the total. But these small systems, there's so many of them. And I think Eric Bendler, who's been on the podcast, he was on the last podcast. He was talking to someone, I think, you know, 80% of these small systems have less than three people working for them. I mean, you know, they're just really under-resourced, whether it be financially or personnel-wise. So it keeps it in the on the front page and raises questions, and therefore it's a potential opportunity for acquisition. The big ones like Jackson, those are still going to be hard to swallow.
Yeah. I mean, as you said at the beginning, there are a lot of different angles we could take on this, but your point about how everybody's kind of reactive. So when these crises happen, there's a lot of talk about it and then it dies down, but we really need sustained investment. I think that that's really the key. Any final thoughts before we sign off here?
No, it is, you're exactly right. You know, and I have family from Jackson who, I mean, if anything, you know, one comment that was sent my way was, you know, it's a failed state, you know, in quotes, not, well, you could say that about the state of Mississippi, but I think they were talking about Jackson. It's like unbelievable that a state capital has 150,000 people that don't have access to water. And is this really a bellwether of really what's to come? Like I mentioned, Boston, why aren't we, you know, California doesn't have power. So it's that we need a sustained effort and interest in infrastructure. There's no secret sauce. It's just, you know, putting effort, time towards it and resources. So, yeah, I mean, make lemonade out of lemons. I think that's all we can do and recognize the problem and deal with it.
Yeah, for sure. And let's hope we're not doing a podcast on this on Cleveland or another city after that. But before we sign off, what's the research team working on these days?
So as you well know, I think we've got capital improvement plan data. We're cleaning, scrubbing that. So we've been looking at hundreds and hundreds of capital improvement plans, which including Jackson's on the list. So we've already done it. That'll be interesting. See what happens. We got something coming out on data centers that I know our EPC report, digital, and their digital strategies is coming out in the next week or so. I know that's in final stages. A couple of interesting research notes, one on biogas in the U.S. actually related to Inflation Reduction Act, and will that drive biogas capture at wastewater treatment facilities? And as I think I've mentioned on Dave McGimsey's Water Values podcast, just about to hit the press, I believe, is one on the Southwest Water and Corix merger that just happened. So a lot of different topics sort of that fall in line with our municipal water, private water, and digital water, and industrial water services.
That Corix one will be interesting. We also have a client webcast coming up Wednesday, September 21st on workforce issues. So the shifting workforce in water. So that'll be interesting as well. Well, thanks for your time, Reese, and we'll chat again soon.
Awesome. Thanks a million, Steph. And I think, honestly, we nailed our timeline. So perfect. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, there you have it. So before we sign off, if you are in Boston, let us know if we can set up a meeting at our new office location downtown. Can't take the train, though, at least the orange line, because it's shut down. So we are 10 minutes from the airport, a couple minutes from the commuter line, a couple minutes from Amtrak, or you can just take an Uber ride. Let us know and be happy to see you. Please subscribe to not only the Waterline newsletter, you can go to our website and sign up for that, but please subscribe to Future Water, more importantly, or equally important, and give us a review. So Future Water Podcast, and send us a note to waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topic ideas you'd like us to discuss. We're doing this for you. Don't sit around and wait for us to come up with ideas. You guys have the best ideas, and tell a friend about it. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, visit us at bluefieldresearch.com. Talk soon, be well, be safe, and have fun.